Hello and welcome to Trashy Divorces.
Hello and welcome to Trashy Royals.
It's a mashup.
A little bit of a mashup this week.
My name is Stacy.
Hey friends, I'm Alicia.
Alicia, what do you have up your poofy sleeve for us this week?
I am pulling two out of our Patreon vault this week. We're doing a Trashy Divorces classic from long, long ago, December 2019. And I want all of us this week, perhaps, to maybe collectively all have a trashy breakup together, as I would like you to break up with the fact that William Shakespeare was William Shakespeare. Because certainly there was a William Shakespeare. I call that guy Stratford Willie, but he's not the guy who wrote the plays. In honor of William Shakespeare's birthday this week, whoever he was, unverifiable one dude, we are putting this one out today for y'all on Trashy Divorces and Trashy Royals. Which podcast are you listening to right now?
If you're not listening to the other one, hey, we'd love it if you did.
We have been bringing you the trashy department, divorces and royals, for a long time. It is our favorite stuff. This one really does mash it up. I love these stories. This is a good one. It's time to get literary. It's time to don your 16th century conspiracy hats to talk about the biggest trick ever played.
Let's go, go, go. So, Alicia, you have long suspected that William Shakespeare might, in fact, not be the William Shakespeare of Shakespeare in Love, the great film of 2000-ish.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
I liked it. I mean, I haven't seen it since back then, but...
Well, I've seen it a bunch. I like that movie a lot.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. Hey, y'all. Welcome.
For Christmas, we should watch Shakespeare in Love, actually.
We're back. I'm excited about this one today. I've been waiting for this one. This one's so good, it's a two-parter. It is Tudor. It is conspiracy. It is trashy. Don ye head coverings made of the finest tin and feathers. This is the literary hill that I will die on. I don't know what the answer to the question is, but...
I think you're not alone in that.
Yeah, what we think we know. Okay, so today we're going to talk about the Shakespeare authorship question and why you should let go of everything they taught you incorrectly in school, because they're a bunch of lying liars. I'd like you to open your mind a little today. I'm going to aim to make the case that the dude that we think is William Shakespeare is not that guy. This is the greatest detective story ever. It is the biggest trick that has ever been played in all of literature. Talk about a patsy. Okay, I know I sound weird. I'm in a different spot because I can't move the cat.
No,
from his napping spot.
He's in a sunbeam in a chair, and it would just be... They just passed that federal rule against animal cruelty, so
dude,
he's safe.
All kinds of awkward. Okay, so let's set the stage, so to speak. See what I did there? Set the stage of how we actually get to Shakespeare and Elizabethan theater. Oh, good. Now there's two cats on my chair. Okay.
Your old chair. Your former chair.
My former chair. The chair that...
That you've lost.
But... Really, guys?
Done. No more chair for you.
We make a very professional podcast. Jesus Christ,
the cuteness is
just
ridiculous here. What you're missing is Inman's blep. He's just looking up with a blep.
Okay, we're literally here for an episode. Okay, back to the point. So we're going to give big props to Henry VIII, actually, for expanding the theater in ye old merry England. Do you want to hear how?
Okay. I can sort of imagine, actually, but yes, I would like to know if my hunch is kind of in the ballpark.
Okay, so the history of acting and how it works throughout England is truly fascinating. But until Henry VIII, acting has been plays of religion, morality, mystery plays, just biblical stuff.
Right.
Maybe there's some folk tales thrown into Robin Hood, King Arthur. These works don't survive, as the people performing these works were mostly illiterate, and they were told verbally and passed down through generations.
It's absolutely
folklore. So these plays get a little bit more exciting as the 15th century progresses, because now we have tournaments. Joust for real, joust for life or death.
No, and there's a scene in The Knight's Tale where they're walking into the stadium, and it's a puppet show, but it's like... the denials of Christ, John sure. the John, no, John, John the Baptist. Anyway, whatever. But yeah, it's that. It's a little religious stage show for children. And three times he denied him, or whatever.
Judas denied Christ.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah. I had to go back to my Catholic school. Judas denied Christ. Thomas doubted. And John the Baptist was like Jesus's older cousin who was super cool.
Yeah, he wasn't one of the disciples, John the Baptist. He's a crazy man in the wilderness.
Okay, so it's tournaments. I love where you get all of your historical...
It's pretty much all from
accurate knowledge. It's Knight's Tale, Shakespeare in Love, mm-hmm. actually... and Game of Thrones. That sums up your
Game of Thrones, yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, the dragons back then, how the profession of exterminator came about, I believe.
Okay. Tournaments are a big deal. Jousting is a big deal. It's serious stuff. And tournaments become bigger affairs. So now there's banquets and feasts and dancing and theatrical entertainment. And for theatrical entertainment, they're bringing in companies to stage and craft this theatrical entertainment, but it's kind of a pay-to-play scheme. They start these mosques. So a troupe comes in and stages it, but they will use lords and ladies of the court to interact within their presentation. So the idea of actually being a professional actor, someone who does nothing but entertain other people, does not fit into the world order of 15th century England. They are considered masterless men. There's no hierarchy. They're not enslaved to anybody. They are completely out of control in the social order. They're not a merchant.
I'm sure they get punished for this, basically.
Kind of.
You can be poor forever, but you can be free.
I mean, but yeah, they're masterless men. And they scare the shit out of England, essentially. So Henry VIII comes on in. And Henry VIII's a pretty nasty dude. Like, beheadings are a thing. The amount of violence that was accepted just by the people of the age between... Like, they'd all go watch beheadings at Tyburn Square. There's bear baiting, which is horrible.
Yeah, we're not
There's
gonna get into that.
Cockfighting. Like, violence is...
Sure.
Of just a natural, everyday thing. But Henry VIII, right, splits from Catherine of Aragon, starts his own new church. Henry's like, hey, I understand that the power of theater that the clergy has in its religious celebrations is kind of a big deal. And I want to do everything I can to rob clergy of the power that they have. So, hey, number one... All religious theater is banned. If it's biblical, if it's mystery, if it's passion, whatever. If it has anything to do with religion, it's out the window. And hey, actors, what else have you got? So it creates this virtual, like, rich pageant of clever plays, romance, like, all kinds of different stuff that has nothing to do with the Bible. Okay. Henry has this massive propaganda job to do, and he knows theater can help get it done. He's trying to win over the people.
Right.
He's Ted Turner. Let me give you a new form of entertainment.
Right.
Also, during this time, because Henry has given his blessing to this flourishing of say what you want, all of Henry's nobles are trying to get in on Henry's side, right? Family alliances and ties. So... Many nobles begin forming their own troops. It's a sign of wealth and power. They're often in competition for the best minstrels and actors. Like, contracts could be lucrative, but you couldn't act or be in one of these things unless you had the permission of a lord.
So they created a highly regulated marketplace for actors and
correct.
Musicians. And that's really, it's... You know, when we talk about cap and trade today, yep. it's the same idea. You're going to sell your credits.
Yep.
This is cool. So the nobles now are competing to get the best talent to be the
to
most
represent them
entertaining.
In their...
Yeah.
That's exactly
That's
right.
That's great.
Well, the Lord's license gave them the right to travel under his charter.
Okay.
Because other... Like, imagine it. You've got a rolling pageant cart filled
sure.
with sets masterless men, crazy actors.
Yeah, no, I'm sure the sheriff in the third town of the day would roust you and steal all your shit.
Well, that's the thing. The roads belong to the nobles and the outlaws. So this whole spectacular thing comes through. It causes quite a stir. And actors are like considered as dangerous. They're, you know, gypsies, tramps, and thieves. They're right. poachers. So having the support of the court and a noble is essential. It's well, and the only and they, way it's going
to
happen.
And they pretend to be people in a way that I think in this era was just mind-blowing for, you know, like mm-hmm. you didn't pretend to be.
No, you were what you were.
Yeah, deception was just, honor was so important. And so this idea that like, wait, you make a living, just you just become someone else for a few hours and you become untrustworthy, basically.
Well, in going back, like I cut this out, but in going back like to the 300 years of medieval times, appearing as somebody else just was it just broke their construct.
Right.
If you are a wool gatherer, you're a shepherd and you do wool. You are not only you in the reality you exist in, you represent every other shepherd that has come before you and every other shepherd that will come after. It is a, yes, to your point.
It blows everything up.
Okay. So during this time, you needed clearance from the Lord Mayor of a particular town. So the acting troupe would set up kind of their portable stage in the best possible location. Maybe they take over an inn. Okay, here's the thing. If you can take over an inn, you can control the entry and you can control the box. You've got the power of the purse in that case. If you're just in the middle of the village, you pass around a hat. But if you can charge admission at the door, it's better for everybody involved. Yeah. And whoever owns the key to the gate, right? So people are now figuring out, whoa, it's not just acting. There's a way to make entertainment profitable where we can really do this for a living. Okay. Henry dies. There's 12 years of shit. But Elizabeth at 25 in 1558, right, ascends to the throne. And this is glorious in our eyes. And she has got a passion for the theater. So in 1559... Bessie's like, great.
Yeah, she's had to pretend to be other people a lot in her life.
She gets it. She loves the theater. Mm-hmm. And so in 1559, Bessie's like, hey, all acting companies, you're cool. I give my royal proclamation that acting is cool. You guys can pretty much do what you want, but here's the deal first. I need you to come to London and show your play to the Lord Mayor before it's released to the public.
Okay. Now, so it's like a censorship commission, basically.
This is totally a way for her to censor what the hell is going on.
Okay.
But it also provides this thing. Like, there's so much of what we know about theater that's founded in this because it gives the troupe a dress rehearsal.
Oh, interesting.
And if that play is approved, then you go to opening night. They're put on in the town halls so you can control the door.
I mean, it's remarkable to think like how much freer that system made, you know, the writing of a play, the creation of a piece of art. Because to us, I think that sounds like a nightmare. Like, wait, the government is just gonna, like, you have to screen your movie for, we have to read your script before you can, like, we got rid of that decades ago. Because that's just a massive infringement on freedom. But for these guys, it must have been like...
We haven't gotten rid of it.
Oh, we got rid of the formal, like the Hayes Commission, all that stuff.
By the government?
Yeah.
But you still have to get your script greenlit.
No, I agree.
It's just gone to a capitalist endeavor.
True. But I mean, she, I'm sure, was making sure... Well, like her people were making sure there was no like down with the monarchy. Not that that would have even been a thought at the time, I guess. But, you know, and nothing strictly blasphemous...
Well, plays now need to be coded. So you can tell a story
right.
when you get down like to Julius Caesar when Elizabeth is closer to her deathbed and Julius Caesar comes out. It's all about who is going to claim the throne. You have so many of those plays that happen to crop up at a time where certain something is happening in Elizabeth's court or the government
right.
that totally makes an analogy to what's going on current day. You just can't talk about what's going on current day.
Sure.
You had to think a little.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Sorry about the neighbor's dog.
Yeah, sorry. Crackers.
That's the dog's name, not...
Yeah. Not the neighbors. So now, acting companies are like flocking to London to beg the Lord Mayor to review their plays. And thus begins the golden age of Elizabethan theater.
Sure.
Public plays are appearing on like temporary stages when they can get an innkeeper. That's great. But then the money goes to the innkeeper. It doesn't go to the actors. So Richard Burbage, who was a carpenter by profession and actor by choice, is like, I can build my own gate. So he has traveled around in that pageant cart. You know, he knows what he can do. So he builds the first permanent stage called the Red Lion in 1576. It is the first place that is ever called a theater. It's the first time in history the word is used to describe a building.
It's amazing that it took 17 years from like the proclamation to getting a permanent stage built in London.
Right. Well, it's a big hit.
Yeah, I'm right? sure. Yeah.
And like a few more pop up. It's an architectural form that is entirely unique. It's not Greek. It's not Roman. They're built in O shapes. There are three levels. We're going to talk about a few things about the theater in a moment. But during this time, there are probably 16 altogether throughout ye olde London town. But I can't say ye olde London town because here's the crazy thing. London at the time is separate, divided by the Thames from a city south on the Thames called, it's spelled Southwark, but it's pronounced Southwark.
I think that's right, yeah.
It's Bankside, okay? Southwark. So the Thames is the border between London and Southwark. And there's a bridge, but it's crowded and slow and dangerous. So like you'd pay a boatman to get you over to the other side. Why would you go to Southwark? Because London's laws don't apply. In Southwark, you have alcohol, prostitution, bear baiting, cockfighting, pickpockets, as well as all the theaters are not dictated by London's laws.
Hmm.
I know, right?
The gin's wetter down south.
Okay.
Although that's probably true.
Here's what I want you to think about and put in context for just a second. You've got 16 theaters, but at some point, as many as 12 theaters currently happening at any one time in ye olde London town. They operate May through October. There's no plays on Sunday. Otherwise, they're showing six shows a week.
Okay. I bet they spaced the time out, too. So if you were near, like, a few blocks from another theater, maybe you would have, like, a 1 p.m. and they would do, like, a 5 p.m. Were all at the same time?
All at the same time.
Oh, weird.
They're all in the afternoon because there's no lighting. You're lit by the...
Gotcha. Okay.
So the plays happen in the afternoon, 6 days a week. The same play is never performed twice. They are running six different plays a week. At the most, you are going to do one play 4 or 5 times in a month.
Okay? That is just such an enormous amount of content.
You're looking at 30 different plays in your repertoire every year for 12 different theater houses.
It's incredible.
That is 360 pieces of content.
I'm imagining dorms full of writers of varying skills. I mean, I know that's not how it worked, but that...
No, but it was how it worked.
Okay, like, I mean, today that's what is done in lots of...
Think about that amount of content that has to be created to sustain that.
It's amazing.
By the turn of the century, as many as 10% of the total population of London, 15,000 Londoners, were at a playhouse given day.
I thought you were going to say, we're writing plays.
No. 10% of the total population of London is sitting in a theater on any given day.
Yeah.
Now, here's how you know what's happening.
And then on Sunday, they are all sitting in churches.
They're sitting in church.
I'm sure at a certain point, we start to get some whatever.
Okay. That's exactly right. Here's how you knew what was happening at the theater house. Because they're in Southwark and they're across the Thames, each playhouse on any given morning would raise a flag up their flagpole showing what type of play they were going to be doing that day. You didn't know what they were going to be doing, but if they
raised a white flag, they were doing a romance or a comedy. If it was a red flag, it's a history play. If it is a black flag, it is a tragedy. So you have 12 theater houses, I think, that are all probably looking at each other.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Like, okay, the Rose is putting up a black flag. We got a red. Oh, we're doing a comedy today.
Right.
So you could kind of choose what I would assume wanted to go see.
Yeah, the owners had to informally be getting together for drinks all the time and like, yeah, maybe we'll, you know. Like, maybe. I'm sure.
I mean, they're all buddy. They're all, yeah.
Yeah, you want to maximize your earnings. Like, everybody wants to.
So each theater, oh my God, is just amazing. They're open air, thatched roof, afternoon productions. You've got, I don't know, the Globe, the Swan, the Rose, the Curtain, but there's a cannon in each one. There's no cannon in it, but they fire it, you know, for battle scenes. They have flies, so a rope and pulley is set up so an actor can be hoisted into the air.
It must have been magical. Just absolutely magical.
There's a trap door in the stage so characters can appear or reappear. There aren't any painted sets. Characters describe in the play where they are. Oh, it's dawn in the... Oh, now we're in the hills of Verona. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Gosh, the desert sand is so gritty on my feet or whatever.
I mean, can you imagine but what this had to look like to the people of London? No wonder 10%. Like, it's movies, music, TV, YouTube. It is like something nobody's ever seen.
Yeah.
Okay. In each theater. Then I swear to God, we're about to get to Shakespeare because it's so much more fun than this. I just
got great, though,
into this rabbit hole and thought setting the stage is going to make the unfolding of this a little bit more contextual.
Sure. Okay. Folded.
So each theater holds thousands of people. You got about 500 on that ground floor. They originally are called the penny stickers because you're controlling the box. Oh, this is something else fun. So people come in. If you're on one of the upper balconies, it's 2 pence. You can get a royal box for 6 pence. But otherwise, if you're a penny sticker, eventually this term is going to come to be known as groundlings. William Shakespeare coins it because he thinks these 500 people all look like fish with their gaping mouths open below the stage. You get in for a penny. So everybody is putting their coins in a box when they come in, hence the name box office that we use today.
Sure. I mean, so they stick a penny in and they are penny stickers?
Penny stickers.
Okay.
I mean, 2 pence or 6 pence. Mm-hmm. The 6 pence boxes were on the third level, so you could kind of, they're more covered than anything else because these are happening rain or shine.
Gotcha. It's London, so yeah, there's no way.
No women, of course. Women are not allowed to own stake in a company, be a playwright, or act. Women have no part of this. Oh, let's see. Musicians get positioned on the upper stage above. Young noblemen, if you had a connection, would go sit in that area so they could be seen. Commercial playhouses are now a thing. Here's something I found interesting. Maybe 25%. Of all of that content written between the years 1570 and 1640 have survived, 25% of it. 75% of the writing from that era is
lost.
Gone.
Yeah.
Thanks, Puritans.
Well, the Great Fire of London, I mean, there's been a lot. There have been a lot of events.
Well, the Globe actually catches on accident where the cannon goes off in the show. Somebody has to dump the beer out on the guy at the embers caught on fire, too. Oh, because they sell oranges and hazelnuts and beer and wine. You can also hook up with your sex worker and arrange that for later. Like, it's body. But one of the embers from that cannon in the Globe got caught in the thatch roof.
Right.
So 2 hours after their performance was done, the thatch roof caught on fire, which burned down the Globe. But because the costumes and scripts were in what they called a tiring room, where you put on your attire. You put your attire on or off. The tiring room is behind the stage. They were able to go in and get all of that stuff out before the theater burns. Sadly, 1642, Reformation and other Cromwell come along. in those 18 years before monarchy is restored, every bit of the theater is gone and wiped out. It's just sad. Golden age of Elizabethan theater.
This is Jess Betancourt, the host of DNA ID, the only true crime podcast that exclusively covers cases solved using forensic genealogy. DNA ID goes behind the headlines to answer your questions about this remarkable new crime-solving tool, how it works, how cases are selected, why the cases were unsolved for so long, and how the justice system is addressing it. I include input from law enforcement to give you the inside scoop that we all crave with a straightforward, no-nonsense delivery. You can find DNA ID on any podcast platform. Episodes come out weekly on Mondays.
Conspiracy time.
Oh, yes. Here we go.
William Shakespeare, considered the greatest writer in the English language, with 36 plays, 54 sonnets, and 2 poems. You know him. You love him.
Sure.
Willie Shakespeare. We learn about him in school.
Yeah.
We have learned all kinds of lying lies is what we've learned about. There's no biographer. There's no biography of Shakespeare, contemporary, to tell us the story of the man. This is a story open to all the possibilities and conjecture, because nothing's there. And you try to ask questions to your teacher, like Hermione Granger, raising her hand like I did. There's no good way that plays out. Just trust me. I know. There was certainly a man named William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare was a Stratford boy. Stratford is a backwater village in Warwickshire in the middle of England. I am going to call William Shakespeare, the man who was born in Stratford, Stratford Willie.
Okay.
This is the man, this is Stratford Willie.
Yeah, this is the recorded human of that name at the time.
The recorded human of that name. I'm going to give you the verified facts, what we can prove that we know about Stratford Willie. In his lifetime, from 1564 to 1616, he is mentioned in 70 documents. Throughout his entire life. Baptism, marriage, birth of children. He's mentioned in money lending documents, a couple of lawsuits, tax records, grain hoarding, and as a theater shareholder. As an actor, he leaves 2 records. Born in April 1564 to illiterate parents. Most people in Stratford at the time are illiterate. They mark their names with an X, and the clerk transcribes them. For the first 18 years of Stratford Willie's life, nothing. November 27th, he marries Anne with a different last name, only to have a new record the following day with Anne Hathaway. Records of his kids being born, he leaves for London. He leaves his family behind in Stratford and just disappears into London for a while. 1592, his name is first mentioned as an actor. It appears on a list of players. In 1610, he returns to Stratford. He's lending money, trading land and houses. He's in some lawsuits. In 1616, his will is dated. That's it. Nothing in any of those records have anything connecting him to his place. He talks in a Stratford dialect, which there is one, and it's distinct. That bit never makes it into any of his work. No evidence he attended any school in Stratford or any school for that matter. There's no evidence that he traveled. There are no plays, no poems, no letters written in his own hand. There are no letters to any friends or contemporaries.
What about his wife? No letters to his wife?
Uh-uh. No.
Because she stayed in Stratford, right? Yeah.
Yeah. None. Zero.
Okay. Cool.
There's...
Although, I guess if she was illiterate, why would you bother?
There's 6 signatures that are supposedly his. They're not from the same person. Like, I'm handwriting analysis,
it's clerks,
girl.
Yeah, it's...
You don't even need the training. It's obvious.
It's clerks, yeah.
All of these are on legal documents. The law clerk can write it in if you have difficulty writing your own name. How do you write Hamlet? How do you write... Any one of the, if you can't write your name. Okay. There's no historical evidence that he ever met Elizabeth I. The only plays that Bessie can ever be tied to seeing or performed at court, there are 2, The Merry Wives of Windsor and Love's Labor Lost. When he dies in 1616, there is no record of anyone making a note of it. It doesn't cause a whisper. It doesn't cause a ruffle. There are no lamentations. There are no write-ups in the paper. No one notices, which is different than every other writer of any kind of prominence at the time, where the country mourns and they're honored in elaborate ways upon their passing. So a kid, Stratford Willie, with no record of schooling, travel, literacy.
His dad was a shoemaker, right? Is that, yeah. Am I remembering that?
He was a mayor of Stratford for like 1 year.
Oh, okay.
Glove maker.
Mm-hmm. Glove, okay, right. I thought it was some sort of clothier. But it sounds like whatever happened in London, he did come back with more, like he had some success doing something in London if he came back and was then trading land and et cetera.
Oh, for sure.
So, yeah, I mean, records are lost, but I mean, something good happened to him there.
Oh, I mean.
Probably he became the most famous English playwright.
No, that is not what he did.
Probably what happened.
He was in a troupe. You can connect him to troupes of actors, which is great. Does his thing, abandons his wife for 20 some odd years, and then comes back when he's ready to die. It's cool. But like, he didn't write these works. There's no way. Okay, so in the works of William Shakespeare, he writes of philosophy, law, classic literature, horticulture, modern history, music, medicine, art, astronomy, military terminology, naval terminology, court life. He knows French, Italian, Latin, Spanish, English. Italian locations and towns. Shakespeare has an innate knowledge of the places and the people in all kinds of environments, from the loftiest to the bawdiest. Tennis, falconry, sports of the upper crust. How do you accumulate that level of learning and not have a scrap of paper, a letter, a correspondence to any contemporary or friend or enemy? And half of this time, Stratford Willie is dividing his time between London and Stratford. There's no communication anywhere, not even to his wife. Hey, honey, it's time to plant the peaches for the year. No, nothing. Zero.
To be clear, that is not how peaches work.
How do you know this kind of stuff if you're not coming to court some way, somehow? Not one record.
Well, and it's in the era pre-novel even, right? Like that, there just wasn't a big, I think Chaucer had happened, but there wasn't just a because today you can, by the time you're 20, if you're a voracious reader, you can have a lot of that terminology. You may be clumsy in how you would use it in writing, but even that wasn't, he wouldn't have been a voracious reader as a child because there wasn't a voracious amount of work to read.
There actually was. Wait just 1 second, because I want to get to that point. But okay. The Elizabethan court records, there are a ton of plays performed in her court. She loves the theater. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare's not attached to any of them. Okay. Books. Books are a big deal. Books are a super big deal if you're landed, if you have money, if you have a library. But those books aren't written in English. Like the English printing press is just coming. Those books and the source texts for so much of the canon of Shakespeare's work, the sources, Latin, Spanish, French, Italian. These, they're not source work. You're reading from the original Greek. You're going to Sophocles and play, oh, let me hear that story that I can read in the original Latin and Greek that I can translate.
I don't suppose the priest or whatever in Stratford was just a great teacher of a really gifted student by any chance.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. So much of his work based on other texts, like you'd need to, if you were Stratford Willie, A, find a way to get possession of that text and well enough to know that other language to get your, like, it's ridiculous. William Stratford Willie doesn't teach his daughters to read. He's the most prolific writer of the time and his children are illiterate.
You're making a strong case.
Thank you.
I will not diminish what you're saying.
There is not a single line anywhere in the works of William Shakespeare that reflect anything about Stratford Willie's own life. Stratford Willie lost a son, not mentioned. Stratford Willie has his own dialect. That dialect from Stratford never mentioned, but St. Albans is mentioned 15 times. Like, you can find like, what artist in the history of the world has never pulled from their own life for their source material? Stratford Willie retires in his late 40s, heads back to Stratford. No more writing ever again. He's all out of ideas. 1613, he's done. He's just done with the writings. I've written all I can.
He gets really into real estate in Stratford.
Whatever. There is no record of travel.
He was in talks to build a Shakespeare Tower.
For Stratford Willie anywhere. No record of travel. And you, like, internationally,
right,
there's intense records. 1/3 of the Shakespeare play canon is set in Italy. 1/3 of it. And you know what? It's accurate. With the streets and the families and the names and who sells the bread on the corner. It is, you're inspired by that because you've seen it and you've been there and you've walked the streets and you know that the intersection of, like, Stratford Willie never leaves the country. Voltaire, when he dies, leaves 20,000 items in his hand. Stratford Willie, zero. The will.
Maybe he just didn't like fame.
Oh my God. The will is the most ridiculous document that ever happened. Now, he's a businessman.
Sure.
Let's call it that. So in his will, he divides out every bit of property down to bowls, swords, even leaves his wife his what? Second best bed.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Divides the riches of the family. Like, everything he's got, every spoon, every grain of anything. Not one book is mentioned in that list in the category of his, and not one book. Books are precious.
Right.
Books are like gold. Stratford Willie
did not own any.
Doesn't own any books that he's taken care of in his will, but he's made sure to leave the second best bed and this bowl and this sword. He makes some provisions for actors that he used to act with, but no books. There is not a mention in his will of him ever being a writer. There is not a mention of any of his manuscripts, any of his legacies, anything he may be working on. None of it. 36 plays, 54 sonnets, 2 famous poems. You cover the second best bed in silver bowl, and you don't talk about the legacy of work in your will and what you want to happen with that. Come on. Come on.
Even Ruby is skeptical. I hear
nothing about his legacy in writing. Nothing. He makes no plans for anything finished or unfinished. He makes no provisions for his granddaughter's education. So his daughters are illiterate. It's not making any kind of big deal to get his granddaughter. Like, come on. Again, when he dies in 1616, no one's interested. Doesn't even, never mention, doesn't make a ruffle. So how do we begin this thing? Stratford Willie to William Shakespeare. How does that happen? 1623. The first folio emerges. Ben Jonson, famous philosopher and prose writer of the day, is staying with famous everything of the day, Francis Bacon. And they put together the first folio dedicated to the sons of Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke. Ben Jonson has never looked in William Shakespeare's direction before. He's never written about him, thought about him, talked about him that we can find in the record. And now we are putting together in a folio the collected works of William Shakespeare. Put him together, 500 copies sold. Never made another ripple. For like 60 years, because we had to get through Puritanism and the other Cromwell. So beginning like 1560s, 1570s, we're looking to, or 1660s, 1670s, we're looking to rediscover old works. And hey,
oh, sure.
Is this folio?
Right, to regain what was lost by the, weirdly, the actual tyrants, the religious fanatics who took over.
That's it. Okay, but here's the weird thing about that. I've got this actually tied back to the back. Okay, so now the first folio is rediscovered, and people are like, huh, Stratford-upon-Avon. So they head on down there, and they're like, where did Shakespeare? There's no, people don't know. People don't remember. And what's there is in old brains. But people are flocking now to Stratford-upon-Avon. And welcome to a 3 million visitor a year tourist industry where nothing there can really be tied to Shakespeare.
Sure.
They sold thousands of Shakespeare's chair back in the 1600s before, you know.
Oh, sure.
They got caught out of that one.
My favorite parallel story is, like, if you Google, like, Noah's Ark Mount Ararat, you will see story after story after story from different years of, like, the remains of Noah's Ark found on Mount Ararat. Different locations, all of them, because over the millennia, enterprising marketers have been dragging shitloads of wood up Mount Ararat and building boats and then charging a nickel a head to go look at the Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
And so they just find these rotted out corpses of boats now.
I mean, that's what they're doing in Stratford-upon-Avon.
That's what they're doing in Stratford-upon-Avon.
And they have created one of the most prosperous
pig pen where William Shakespeare's pigs were born. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
This is the field where his wife planted their peaches every spring. Again, not how peaches work.
Okay. I don't know who wrote the books, but it wasn't Stratford Willie. There's nothing that connects that man to the writer of the Shakespearean canon. I don't really think any reasonable person
could make a suggestion?
Yeah.
Certain time-traveling alien? No blue box.
Oh, maybe. Sure. Yes.
Doctor Who?
Doctor Who. That makes way more sense than Stratford Willie.
Sure.
Who was born and died in Stratford. It's stupid. Now, here's the thing about theater. Is as open and honest as it was, by the 1590s, Puritans had kind of come in and they closed the theater at some point due to the plague, bubonic. Puritans are getting kind of yippy about what's going on. So plays become a little bit more shaded. There's more coded stuff. When theater was shut down in Southwark, court plays were still happening at Elizabeth's court. They just had to be a little bit more coded. So in that, there are a lot of writers and playwrights who get hung up during this period of time. Theater's bad, and you don't want your name attached to it necessarily. And now you've got Walsingham, who is the master of the Star Chamber and in charge of all this stuff, and he's got the ability to torture anyone. So how do you code it? How do you still write? How do you still get your art out, but make sure that it's not...
Yours.
Okay. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. Before we go to that, I want to talk about some other examples of how they were gunning for playwrights, just to set the stage. Thomas Kidd, in prison, dies a broken man. Christopher Marlowe, we're going to talk a little bit about him. So you'd want to remain anonymous. Remaining anonymous is a wise choice. You have a bunch of playwrights, Thomas Kidd, Christopher Marlowe, Ben Jonson, is in the Slammer 3 times. Like, it's good. So let me tell you what we don't know in 2019 that they absolutely knew in 1595 is that Shakespeare means nom de plume. You shake a spear. It is the common accepted term for an anonymous work. Bill Smith, John Adams. It is the generic name that you put to a nom de plume. That's it. There are hundreds of plays that are credited to William Shakespeare. The London Prodigal, the second maiden's tragedy, that are never claimed in Shakespeare's canon. What is claimed is that first folio document. There are hundreds of works that William Shakespeare's name is on because it's cover name. You put it on when you don't want to be recognized for the work you're doing because you don't want Elizabeth to throw you in the galleys.
I feel like you've made a very persuasive case, and I apologize to all of our English listeners who are about to unsubscribe from our Patreon.
I think our English listeners know better than anyone.
Probably.
Like, they probably got their hands smacked too by asking this in school, but there are 87 different authorship possibilities that have been documented by academia through time. 87 different possibilities. Like, this is not, come on, use your common sense. William Shakespeare, it's a nom de plume. Throwing on everything.
Noah's Ark.
That's it. You would literally have to believe in miracles or time lords for Stratford Willie to have written the works of William Shakespeare. You're not alone. You're like, hey, Alicia, you're talking some sense. I'll give you my 28 references. I've been studying this for years. We're not alone in our thinking. There are a lot of doubters to this story. My favorite, Mark Twain. The last book that Mark Twain wrote before his death is Shakespeare Dead. Ironic that Mark Twain, his real name is Samuel Clemens, and had a nom de plume his whole life. Mark Twain's right. Who else believed in this crazy whack-a-mamie theory? Thomas Hardy, Samuel Coleridge, Walt Whitman, Otto von Bismarck, James Joyce, Charlie Chaplin, Leslie Howard, Henry James. It is so, I don't know who did, but it wasn't Stratford Willie.
There's really, I mean, obviously you'll be researching this, but there's good reason to think that this was a consortium of authors, not a single author, right?
That's my case.
Okay.
That's absolutely my, I think it is, well, ish.
These are, here are my three plays that really might run afoul of authorities, but they're very good. Can we put them in this folio as William Shakespeare?
Yes and no. Like, I think the canon is probably contributed by a number of different people.
Right.
We're gonna talk about it. We're gonna talk about it, and I will let you come to your own conclusions.
But I mean, think about it. Like, at this moment where sort of the, you know, the mental fertility of the English writing class has been unleashed, this would be the distillation of their best work.
Oh yeah.
And it really does flow into everything that you're saying. And it maintains the purity of, you know, the celebration of the English writing culture at the time.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, you're going to love next week.
I'm sure.
You're into it. You're sitting up in your chair. I think I've convinced you. My point today.
No, you have. I've heard this theory like throughout my life. I mean, I think in high school we talked about it even like when we were studying
Shakespeare. You had a better teacher than I did.
Well, it was really just presented as like there are a lot of people who think Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare. And that was kind of the extent of it. But I've never heard the case laid out kind of point by point and all of the things that are missing.
From Stratford Willie's biography that you'd need.
That mm-hmm. should exist too.
Yes. You've got, it's fascinating. I hope you enjoyed the history of Elizabethan theater. And
thank you, Crackers, for your input. Thank you, Ruby, for your input.
If you are interested in learning more just about the Shakespeare authorship theory, I can recommend definitely go to YouTube and pull up a guy named Kier Cutler, K-I-E-R, Cutler. He does a number of different performances. There's a lady named Diana Price. She's very good. But you can, there's a Frontline episode, the Shakespeare mystery. Like, there are a million different resources out there that you can go look up. I'm not telling you anything that can't be verified. Stratford Willie is not William Shakespeare. End of story. That's all I got. You can take off your head covering of tin and feathers now.
Farewell, United Kingdom listeners. It's been lovely having you.
And I think let me hear from you. Like, do you think I'm nuts or did I make my case? All right. That's all I got.
Cool. All right, Alicia, when last we talked, Stratford Willie, you were suggesting, had not in fact been
the
greatest English language writer of all time.
Nope, not the guy. I hope in part one I made my case for Stratford Willie is not the guy. Today, we're going to continue with part two of the Shakespeare mystery. I call this, I could have been a contender. Because we're going to continue with the greatest mystery that has happened in the literary world. If it's not Stratford Willie.
The canon.
Who could it be? Who's in contention for maybe this person wrote Shakespeare? Lots of candidates here. all with way more exciting resumes and qualifications than Stratford Willie. Like, for real. All of these people have left letters, signatures, records all over the place.
I like how anti-underdog you are in this story.
They've traveled. They knew languages. They were connected at court. Some in high status, some as anti-establishment rebels, but they're all there, unlike old Stratford Willie. So the term, if you don't believe that Stratford Willie wrote the canon, you are considered an anti-Stratfordian. That is the proper term for non-believers.
Not Shakespeare truther.
Not Shakespeare truther. Not Shakespeare gate. Shakesgate.
Shakespeare denier.
We are, if we accept the premise that Stratford Willie did not write the canon, we are anti-Stratfordian.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm going with Shakespeare truther, but you do you, babe.
Who else could be a candidate? We have a lot of them. In fact, like 87. We're not going to talk about 87, but we are going to talk about a few of them today. And dig deeper into one of the more likely and then some more tin and feather head covering conspiracy time.
Love it.
Okay. First guy, Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson is the guy who creates, prints, and dedicates the first folio. This is the compiled work of all the works that have the name of Will Shakespeare on them, at least the ones that are claimed. Now, Ben Johnson's kind of a big deal. He's super learned. He could have done it. But the thing I think about Ben Johnson is that he writes of the common man, whereas William Shakespeare writes of the court and loftier sometimes matters than the common man's plight. Johnson has a different realm of vision than what Shakespeare is interested in. I'm not saying old Ben wouldn't have contributed some scenes here and there, because remember, that's the thing. Let's just go back over that content creation wheel again. 12 operating playhouses, operating 6 days a week from May to October, never doing the same play 2 days in a row in between tragedy, comedy, history, and romance. You've got 30 plays in a repertoire for each of these playhouses every year, just for 1 year. 360
right.
pieces of drama, hot, fresh, new, piping hot plays need to be created a year for 70 years of Elizabethan theater.
It's pretty amazing.
Content creation central. So who's to say that some of the best scenes out of Shakespeare weren't contributions
sure.
by writers as they're sitting around in the pub? Oh yeah, ha ha ha, what would be funny is to do this. Okay. But Ben certainly maybe a contributor. He's instrumental in the first folio. He is one of the three people in the whole world who know who the real author is. Ben Johnson.
Right.
But I don't think Ben Johnson is the real author.
Right. No, but I would say that his production of the first folio is pretty clear evidence that he was involved in the...
For sure. And we're going to talk about his eulogy.
Let's call it a conspiracy.
That's first folio truthers. Kat, do you have to help all the time?
Yeah, of course he does.
Okay, next up. In the I could have been a contender, Francis Bacon. Now, old Frankie Bacon is a master of learning. This is kind of an interesting segue. I don't have it written down. But Delia Bacon, no relation to Francis Bacon, but Delia Bacon in 1856 is the first person to question an inquiry. She wrote it into Putnam's, like, could Shakespeare have really written all these things? Francis Bacon was her likely candidate. There is a Kraken 4-hour Shakespeare code that legit was even too whacked out for me, trying to prove that Francis Bacon is it. And I was all in when we were talking about codes and the way the type was set and the lowercase and the uppercase.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a kerning issue. Yes. No, can I just interject that if Francis Bacon were alive and notable today, he would be known as Frank Bake.
Frank Bake. I like it. That's perfectly true. Well, Frank Bake, I was in for as being in this cracking the conspiracy code thing until they brought out the protractor. So they're making angles connect and like I was done. Okay. But
so alien. It was aliens.
The code part is cool because you see Bacon all through the first folio, like a big fat hint. Delia Bacon's premonition was that Francis Bacon was the coordinator of all of these works. It's good to remain anonymous. They're trying to push forward this new ideal of the way they want the world to work, but they can't do it in their positions of power, so they do it through theater. Mm-hmm. Her supposition is it's Ben Jonson with most of the plays written by Sir Walter Raleigh, which is weird. But let's talk about Frank Bake.
Frank Bake.
Frank and Bake. Okay. Ben Jonson mm-hmm. is staying with Frankenbank when the first folio period is being collected and printed and published. They're good buddies.
So they're in cahoots. They're in cahoots. What you're saying.
So like Frank Bake could totally be a likely candidate.
I love a story where the word cahoots applies. So here we go.
Shenanigans. Mm. Uh-huh. He is totally a likely candidate, maybe for some, but not all of the plays. Like, he's a logical choice. He did serve as Lord Chancellor of England. He was connected. But, come on, Francis Bacon. Do you see him being fascinated by what is happening at court to the degree that Shakespeare is? Like, he has better things to study, like the scientific method that he invents. Empiricism. Is Ben Jonson really going to write pages after pages of iambic pentameter so naturally and sweetly with the elegance of a prose writer and a... No, dude. It's not Ben Jonson. He's not a great dramatist. Like, he knows philosophy, he knows prose, but I can't see him getting lost in hundreds of thousands of lines of iambic pentameter.
I would just point you to Alexander Hamilton as one example of a mind that can kind of go...
Dude, just, that guy was great at hip hop.
Range widely, right? Like, noted
so
hip hop pioneer, also founder, one of the founders of the American government.
Sure.
Just saying, like, I see what you're saying. And also, like, sometimes, I mean, there are minds that.
I don't know. Francis Bacon is brilliant, but I don't see Francis Bacon legitimately dwelling in the range of environments that you would need to be comfortable in to write the canon sure. as a sole author.
Right. Okay. I don't think we're looking at a sole authorship issue, though.
I don't either.
Okay.
That's my big tinfoil hat conspiracy. Well, I do have one sole author theory-ish, but I have it's a contribution from a ton of authors Ben Jonson compiles together. Sir Henry Neville is offered up as being a contender as well. Sir Henry Neville is from those Nevilles. Henry Neville is kind of a fringe theory. Henry Neville... Henry Neville is born from the Neville family that branched from the daughter of John of Gaunt,
oh my God.
Who is the sperm donor for the entire Tudor Revolution.
Yeah.
His descendant is Joan Beaufort of the Beaufort line. Do you remember the Beauforts who were, because of the mistress, like they're never allowed to claim the throne? Henry Neville of the Neville family could have been a candidate. He was... learned, he was in the right places at the right time, but I have more exciting theories to talk about than this cockamamie one. But he could have helped. Again, right name, right qualifications, connected the right way. But hey, Alicia, you're talking about the people at court. What about the actual playwrights? Like, wouldn't we look at playwrights of the time actually being the one who wrote the plays? Okay, cool. Let's talk about him. Thomas Kidd. Thomas Kidd, not a goat. Could have maybe. He's an actor, too. He would get a lot of it. He is strung up enough times within the authoritarian Elizabethan government, certainly to want some revenge in court. He is the author of the Spanish tragedy. He's really prolific in the 1570s and 1580s, but Thomas Kidd dies in 1594, the year that Shakespeare kind of starts to break through. Okay. So let's talk about another famous actor and playwright of the day. Christopher Marlowe. Kit Marlowe.
Certainly heard him.
This is a fun one. Okay, so Kit Marlowe. He's a dramatist. He wrote the famous plays Tamburlaine. Again, he's working in the 1570s and 1580s. He's pals with Thomas Kidd. And there is a lot of homosexual activity happening in the scene, which is totes cool with me. But again, not... totes cool with the Elizabethan authorities of the time. Now, Kit Marlowe does get a degree. He is supported in the arts to an extent. He was not a proper born boy, so he kind of worked his way up. There are also rumors and maybe some facts, too, that when he got sent to college on his fancy scholarship, it was really so he could be recruited as a spy for Walsingham's spy ring.
Which actually would not be crazy. I mean,
no, it's not. I mean, not crazy at all. So in 1593, there is a writ of arrest taken out against him. And his friends take Kit Marlowe out and kill him. So here's the deal. No, dude, this is the craziest story you've ever heard. The murder of Christopher Marlowe is like one of the, this is the second greatest mystery. Okay, so here's the deal. All of his friends are in a pub. They're drinking, having a great time. But at the end of the night, old Kit Marlowe is dead. And his friends, when the authorities come around, are like, oh yeah, Kit died. We killed him. But we put him in the bottom of this plague victim pit. So, like, you can go find him if you want to, but it's fine, really.
So, Kit Marlowe just disappears.
Kit Marlowe just disappears. And the authorities are like, yeah, we hear there's been a murder. And they're like, yeah, he's at the bottom of the this pit or that one. We don't remember. We were drunk.
Right.
But the matter is dropped.
Yeah, feel free to go diving in the plague pit.
Matter's dropped.
See what you can find.
Yeah. So, is Kit dead or did Kit flee persecution and maybe just get out to Italy and write the Italian part of the Shakespeare canon?
Interesting.
Like, he has connections in England. So for those who would be in the know about his possible survival and escape plan,
right,
it would be easy to publish those anonymously. And hey, we need content. Old Kit's over there writing about the streets of Verona with the exact right location of that baker. Sure. Maybe Kit Marlowe too. Okay. It's a fun one. This is the last of the contenders for today. Edward de Vere.
Okay.
The Earl of Oxford. Now, if you believe that Edward de Vere is the guy who wrote the Canon of William Shakespeare, you are known as an Oxfordian.
Okay.
I can't go this far. I am definitely an anti-Stratfordian, but I don't know. Let's make a case for Earl of Oxford. We talked about this dude, Eddie de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford, back in the episode with the Court of Elizabeth I, Part 2. He is a big deal. Eddie de Vere is the nephew of Puppy Boy.
Okay. Okay. Right. All right. Now I remember.
Nephew of Puppy Boy. Eddie de Vere's mom is sisters with Puppy Pony Boy, Robert Dudley. Okay. There is a great movie that's mainly bogus about this dude called Anonymous, which makes the case that he is the author. It's very pretty to look at. It's a fun 2 hours. It'll get you thinking, but I wouldn't take it as historically accurate.
Sure.
Okay. The Earls of Oxford, the De Vere family, they are centuries and centuries of power players. They signed the Magna Carta. They fought with Richard the Lionheart. They fought with Henry V and Henry VI. They were on the side of the Red Rose Lancastrians in the War of the Roses. They are warriors and power brokers. Okay. This theory comes up when this guy in the 1920s with the last name of Lowney, spelled Looney, but it's Loney. Yeah.
We'll be nice, yeah.
He is looking for a dude. Because he knows Willie Stratford didn't do this, but he's looking for someone to be this person. So he goes on a hunt of all scholastic hunts. And the writer is going to need to have some qualifications. Let's just go over those again. Born in the middle of the 16th century of England with knowledge of court and crown, underlings, law, land, war, maritime battles and exploration, aristocratic sports, including tennis, falconry, dance, music, nature, jousting, the classics of Greece and Rome, flowers, gardens, astronomy, medicine, philosophy, geographic knowledge of Scotland, and a variety of towns in Italy and throughout Europe. In addition, this person is going to need to pretty much have the most profound powers of expression in the language that have ever been made. Shakespeare makes up tens of thousands of new words. Like, you're looking for a specific individual. So Lowney goes through and he's like, oh, okay. I found this work by who they hail as the greatest poet of the time, Edward de Vere. They say he's the most prolific writer of the time, but I can only find these three poems that he wrote. Where is the rest of what he wrote if he is the most prolific, celebrated writer of the time? If we go with the premise that Shakespeare was a nickname, okay, it's a nom de plume. Hold on. Eddie de Vere, the de Vere crest, is a lion shaking a spear. Okay. I'll give you a little bit more about Eddie de Vere. He's born in 1550. He manifests early as a child prodigy. He goes to college at 8. He has a degree by 10. Like, this is... He's a brain.
Even knowing that the standards were wildly different. Yeah, that's still an enormous accomplishment.
But he's born into court. Like, he's got the best tutors of the day, but he's Sheldon.
But even there, he stands out, yeah.
He goes to college at 8. Let me give you a little bit of background on him. Besides the kid being a prodigy, manifesting his talent early as a writer and thinker, his maternal uncle is a guy named Arthur Golding, who is making the translation of Ovid's Metamorphoses for the first time in English from the time Edward was about 12 to 16.
Okay, so he comes from a brainy family, is what you're saying.
His other uncle, we're going to talk about his other uncle, Henry Howard, is a wonderful poet. And Henry Howard, of those Howards, invents blank verse, which is the first used sonnet form, which will in turn become the Shakespearean sonnet.
Sure.
His uncle invents blank verse.
I feel like there's some evidence here to consider.
Eddie knows Greek, French, Italian, Spanish, Latin. He is a hunter. He loves nature. He's a great athlete. He's great at jousting. He wins a fancy tournament at the age of 21 and another one at the age of 31. The rumor about this kid is he is descended from Pallas Athena. And remember Pallas Athena, who grows fully formed from the head of Zeus, comes out shaking a spear. Eddie de Vere kind of has a sad life. Here's just a, we're going to talk about a sad life in a second. When he's 10, okay, his dad, the Earl of Oxford, has Oxford's men. He has a troop of players.
Okay.
Because he's high noble.
Sure.
That support. He has actors and all the guys traveling around under the guise of his license. When Edward de Vere is 10, Will Summers, one of those guys, he is the clown, Will Summers, and his father's acting troupe. And Eddie de Vere is devastated. He really likes Will Summers. But here's the thing about Will Summers. He was Henry VIII's clown at court,
okay,
as well as the clown for Bloody Mary and Edward VI. Will Summers is legendary at Henry VIII's Tudor court, which is like, whoa, I didn't know he had a job working there after he left Henry VIII's court.
So is he very, very old at the time?
He's old. Yeah, he's in his 60s by that. Yeah.
Young Eddie knows him. Okay.
Poor Eddie, right? Two brilliant uncles. He grows up with a dad who is supporting a theater troupe. Like, he's got every bit of the innate knowledge by 10 that you need, but hold up. His dad, when he's 12, dies.
Mm.
He's healthy. There's nothing wrong with dad. The rumor is he's been poisoned by his bitterest rival. You want to take a guess who that is? Puppy Boy. Robert Dudley is his bitterest rival.
Okay.
And Robert Dudley pretty much poisons him, takes over all of the Earl of Oxford's lands. Eddie de Vere is placed as ward of the crown. And guess where Eddie de Vere gets sent to for the rest of his education? William Cecil's house. Yeah, William Cecil's house. He's taken away from his mom. His mom, Marjorie Golding, is indecently quickly married off.
And there's reason to believe that William Cecil murdered Robert Dudley's wife, Amy Robsart. Is that, following the strings? Okay.
Yep.
This is really, okay.
Did it all comes to, everything is connected.
Yeah, I worry if listeners have not gone back and listened to the hundreds of hours of things that we've posted.
Okay, so...
William Cecil was Elizabeth I's enforcer and intelligence chief.
And
perhaps committed some misdeeds in an effort to save her from herself.
He is her terribly loyal Secretary of State throughout her reign.
Yeah.
Okay. Eddie DeVere's mom, Marjorie Golding, gets married off indecently quickly, like within 2 months, to this guy named Sir Charles Tyrrell, who is...
House of Flowers?
No. He's the henchman for Robert Dudley.
It's a Game of Thrones joke.
I get so mad about this. Like, poor Eddie DeVere. So this whole poisoned by rival takes over lands. Mom marries quickly. This is the beginning sequence of Hamlet. Except the murderer and the marrier are combined into one figure, which is Claudius.
Interesting.
Okay. So by 12, poor Eddie DeVere is familiar with the human condition. Life is brief, and the gods do not interfere. He is stripped of everything. He doesn't get anything back for another, like, 30 years. And he had to fight for that, and he still dies of pauper. The most learned, brilliant man in England. It's just, it blows me away. Okay. He does thrive in the home of Cecil.
Cecil was no slouch on the brain thing either.
Cecil's no slouch on the brain thing. He's still got very good tutors. Cecil is training him to be a leader, right? A leader of men. Cecil also has another plan. This is so sad. So Edward de Vere writes his first play when he's 12, and it's called Romeus and Juliet.
That doesn't ring a bell.
Romeus and Juliet, he writes when he is 12. And it is about a girl named Mary Hastings, who he is originally engaged to. But that engagement is broken. And he, Cecil, plans to marry his own daughter to advance his status to Eddie DeVere. Cecil marries his daughter to Eddie DeVere.
I thought you were still talking about the play. Okay.
No, Mary Hastings is Romeus and Juliet. He writes the play about her. Poor Mary Hastings never marries.
Okay, so Eddie DeVere is in love with this person, Mary Hastings.
They are engaged at 12.
So he writes this play about her.
Well, the engagement is broken because Cecil wants to marry his daughter so she can have a title to DeVere.
Okay.
Dudley and Cecil are holding all of his money.
Okay.
Now Cecil's like, and now I want your title, and I'm going to break this engagement that your dad made with Marjorie Golding for you. I'm going to have you marry my daughter instead. DeVere and his daughter Anne are both unhappy. Like, this is the worst marriage compromise that's ever been done. But Eddie DeVere, heartbroken, writes Romeus and Juliet after this broken engagement.
Okay.
Mary Hastings never gets married.
Does anyone know what Romeus and Juliet was?
And Juliet.
Like, do we know that? Are there copies that exist?
Yeah.
Okay. It's written by a 12-year-old.
It's written by a 12-year-old.
Who the fuck is going to keep that around for centuries? Okay.
Journaling is a big deal. Okay. He marries Cecil's daughter at like 15. By 20, he's a Knight of England. He's an honored man of letters. He's considered an outstanding poet. He wants to be a writer, but he cannot reason in his big, big fat brain how an aristocrat and a leader can be committed to art and writing as well. Like, those two things just do not form a construct in his head that he can deal with.
Right.
But he's loyal to Elizabeth, monarch and patron. It is rumored, and this is the plot of Anonymous, that he was a consort of Elizabeth in the 1570s. Him being much younger, they had a child.
Wait, sorry. It's rumored that he had liaisons with the queen and they had a child.
Who was then adopted by the Earl of Southampton. He and his wife, Mary Brown, had been childless for 8 years. And that child was adopted.
And they just tucked her into poofy dresses and sent her on progress or whatever?
I mean, it's hard to tie that time with Elizabeth as being out of court or in confinement or anything like that. But it's a rumor.
Should the flu for 8 or 9 months?
Right. Okay. I don't know. Truth will out. I mean, maybe not. So I'm going to go back a little bit.
just to give some more beef for this kid.
Okay.
When he's 11, he is watching Queen Elizabeth being entertained by his father's own group of players. Remember, his dad dies at 12. Lord Burleigh, William Cecil, and he have a very tense and difficult relationship. And remember, Cecil is always the power behind the throne. And if you think he controls England in a particular way, he controls his house in the exact same way. Cecil, not a great dude, unless you're into that kind of thing. So all of Cecil's letters right now, all of his household letters and accounts are at Hatfield House. Some of these letters that are collected there have been written by Edward. So it's a glimpse into his life. They reveal kind of a passionate, headstrong playboy. He's a favorite of Queen Elizabeth, but he hangs around with all sorts of nefarious characters, and he's always in trouble, like for real trouble. When he's 17, the undercook of the household is dead. And the story is that the undercook ran into Eddie's sword to commit suicide. That's what they say. The undercook just straight ran into Eddie's sword. Yeah. Okay. Years later, Devere hints that it was murder.
You think?
Yeah. But self-defense, if not suicide, is what was argued by Cecil to keep Eddie out of trouble. Cecil provides him with exactly the environment and education to be the person who could have written the canon. He's taught by the greatest. His tutors are the best in England. He is a Latin scholar. He has degrees multiple from Oxford and Cambridge. Then he goes and studies law. Mary Cecil's daughter. I don't know. Like, who besides an aristocrat is going to have the time in a day and the education to sit down and write plays like this? You can't do that if you're tending sheep or milling wool or selling grain or making glove. Like, you just don't have that kind of time for literary pursuits. All right. Here's the other thing with Hamlet. Oxfordians say Hamlet is one of the best pieces of evidence that Devere is Shakespeare. They say old Cecil is the model for Polonius in Hamlet. If you remember, Polonius has this list for rules for a successful life.
Gotcha.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be. Whatever, there are hundreds of them. He has his own list, but only someone in Cecil's household would have been able to see that list, know that list, and twist it to use it as satire within the Hamlet play. It's kind of interesting. This is a very satirical Cecil's list for living.
Right, no, I mean, it would make perfect sense to...
You write about what you know.
Well, but to later use your art to mock your hated, like, quasi-stepfather or whatever that...
That's it.
You're a ward, so he's your warden? Is that... Whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So, but here's the deal. Even though it's a satirized Cecil, no consequences. Everybody knows Polonius in Hamlet is William Cecil, but there's no retribution. There are no charges. Nobody's brought in for questioning. The crown arrests members of the Lord Chamberlain's men in 1601 on the eve of the Earl of Essex rebellion. But Shakespeare's not questioned in that. No one named William Shakespeare is questioned. You know why? Because Shakespeare does not exist. It's a nom de plume. It's a cover name. So the good thing about Stratford Willie, if you are an Oxfordian, is that that guy existed and was nice enough to put his name on all these undercover works, because Devere, not reconciling aristocrat writer, still is writing all the time. Okay. He puts down his pen in the late 1570s, 13 years after he puts down his pen. There's some kind of intervention that happens with Cecil and Elizabeth, and he gets a little bit of his stuff back, but the theory is he is, it's just the saddest life for him because he's suffering to be publishing all of these works that are changing the world without his own name. It is highly gossiped about that he is still writing, but as a nobleman, he can't admit that he's also a playwright. It's not the thing you aspire to if you hold the second highest peerage in the land and you're a favorite of the queen.
I feel like this is a strong case that he created.
No, super strong case.
Much of the canon here.
Super strong case. I mean, he's got all the check marks that you'd need. He is one of the greatest Elizabethan poets. He's lauded, if you go back to records at the time, lauded as the greatest thing since the sliced bread. You can't find any of his shit. So what? If it's a nom de plume, shake a spear, it's his crest, Pallas Athena. Like, you can kind of get how he becomes a good candidate. There's a little bit that happens with him. He has a mistress, Anne Vavasor, who...
Sorry. I thought you said Anne Vavasor, and I was like, what is a Vavasor?
Anne Vavasor. He's in trouble with Elizabeth, blah, blah, blah. By 1598, there are rumors that the Queen and Cecil are compelled to use a pseudonym for him. So maybe Elizabeth and Cecil totally in that it is De Vere. Maybe he's all doing this in hiding. He dies in 1604. His tomb, when he dies, is gone from the cemetery, which is weird. It's there one day and it's not there the next. The rumor is he's reburied in Westminster. He dies in 1604. So hang tight and just jump with me here. The first folio is being compiled in 1621, 1623, like early 1620s. And what is significant about that date that relates to Eddie De Vere? Like, I can't find it. Like, why would Ben Jonson make it then? If De Vere's been passed away for 15 years, why not do it upon his death, right? Like, there's nothing that really connects De Vere to De Vere's passing or something in his life to the publication of the first folio. Here's where it gets exciting. Is a man, De Vere or any other man, going to write about women the way that Shakespeare does and write about men the way Shakespeare writes about men? There's a lot of self-absorption of male behavior in the works of Shakespeare. If you look at the canon, women are written about quite well. In a time when women don't factor into a lot of things, there are a number of common themes about women that run through the canon. So let's take a look, covering high themes here. There's a fascinating lecture that I watched that details all the different plays that these themes are found in. I can take you through that, but we don't have that kind of time. But prevalent themes within the Shakespeare canon: women dressing up as men, women wishing they were men, women who defy their fathers, women who are unjustly accused, women who make fools of men or at least make them mighty uncomfortable, women who lead armies, women who travel. Travel is never a barrier for women in Shakespeare plays, ever. When travel is a barrier for everyone, never in the works of Shakespeare. Going back to the list, women are shown as close with other women. The longest scene in Richard III is between the three most powerful women in the play. Women and their intimate moments are added into the canon over time. Original plays that are published do not have some of these tender scenes with intimate moments. The plays include women who invert the order of things. There are 19 mothers in the works of Shakespeare, many with a lot of power. Women have no problem proposing to men in the Shakespeare canon. There's an incredible amount of text that takes place in the daily work of the kitchen and the living room and the household and cooking operations and how a home is run. It is just simply built in and woven into the texture of the plays. Sewing and mending, needlework, children, child rearing, the nature of kids. Oh, and the identification with animals in the plays, like in a way that no other writer of the time does, because animals are for hunting and eating. In the Shakespeare canon, animals are given feelings. We feel sorry for the animals. It's a very different thing. So I think there are a lot of different ways maybe that we haven't thought about that women are included into these plays, which could be one of the reasons why the works are so popular, because they actually accommodate for both sexes, which is an unusual thing for works at the time. So now I'm going to make my case for Is Shakespeare a Girl? Ooh. Let me introduce you to Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke, on part three in the conclusion of the Shakespeare mystery. But if I put her story in this story, your eyes would glaze over. It's a two-hour episode, and we just can't do that. So
okay.
Here are your male contenders. Mm-hmm. When we come back, part three, Mary Sidney. I love her. She's awesome. I cannot wait to talk about her.
All right.
So stay tuned.
Yeah.
For part three.
Cool.
I kind of ended abruptly there with a cliffhanger. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there's a really good case for Edward de Vere to have written quite a bit of it.
Yes. But the thing with de Vere and most of the threads that are pulled to him are taken from the works. So they're going and reading Shakespeare works and finding lines that could relate to anything that had to do with de Vere.
Yeah, reverse engineering. Yeah.
Legit. He's scholar, like, he absolutely has the knowledge and assimilation of the world to be the guy. And maybe he's one of the guys.
That would be my suggestion.
Maybe they're all one of the guys.
Yeah, I don't think that Shakespeare was a single. I don't think that the canon was single author.
I don't either. Multi-author. You're going to love Mary Sidney next week.
I think this is the most successful writers collective that has ever occurred.
I would agree with that. Yes. That was fun.
Don Johnson.
Ben Johnson. Benny J.
Eddie D.
Benny J. Frank and Bake. Hey, y'all. It's Alicia and Stacy back in present day. And
hello.
Stacy, I'm going to say that was still fun. Mm-hmm. That was so much fun. A few things before we take it out of this episode. At the end of that episode, I did mention a part three to that series. Both for Trashy Divorces and Trashy Royals patrons, look on your Patreon feeds. I will be dropping that original unedited episode after this one comes out as a bonus for all levels this week.
Mm-hmm. Trashy Divorces listeners, we will be back Wednesday for you with all new marital misadventure.
And Trashy Royals folks, we're coming back for you Thursday with a thread that was mentioned in this episode that I've been wanting to tell you for a long, long time.
It truly is our delight to play in this trashy world and whatever side you're listening from.
And we hope it's both. Y'all, thanks everybody for tuning in. And in whatever way you do it, keep it trashy.
Big love, everybody.
Have a good one, friends.
Bye.
Bye.